Do you think then that the TV in modern society has become a false idol? Because what you see in most homes is that the TV occupies the most prominent place in the house, and it's on most of the time that people are at home, and everybody is kind of huddled around it.
Yeah. It's like a god, yes. It's certainly the culture, or the anti-culture, whichever you like. It's certainly that which occupies a large part of whatever grows in people's minds. Whatever is growing in people's minds, like whatever is growing in a garden. If a human being is alive, there's something growing in his mind. There's some growing area in his mind. And television, the newspapers occupy a large part of that section of human minds. And therefore, television forms a huge part of today's culture.
In fact, one thing that is noticeable is that TV screens are everywhere. You must notice this when you travel by airplane.
Yes.
There's always a TV screen that's showing you some program while you're flying.
Yes, that's in the airports, it's in the stations, it's everywhere. It's the screen of Big Brother.
Once I was at Canadian Tire at the waiting room there, and of course they had a TV screen that was beaming some program at us. And maybe there is some reaction to it, because I know one of the people in the waiting room then said, "We don't really need this."
Well, there's reaction in that sense of wanting to turn the machine off. One wonders whether that was the reaction of most people present. Possibly a lot of people present were happy that the machine was on, because they've got nothing else to occupy their minds. So they're happy to have this continual flow of noise and flow of images to just occupy their minds. But it is a reaction, and it shuts the machine off. It's a good reaction, but a lot of people at that point will say, well, there's an emptiness. They're filling their minds and hearts with this television. So that if there's no television there, their minds and hearts are empty, and they feel the emptiness, and they resent the emptiness.
So in other words, people, let's say, can go back and forth. They get tired of the TV, they turn it off, but then they don't have anything to do, so it goes back on again.
That's what's liable to happen. TV has taken over people's hearts and minds, has taken over their lives.
Now, does this intrusion of mass media into our lives, has this given the architects of the New World Order, whoever they are, a very strong tool in which to mold modern man and get them to go wherever they like?
Oh, it's huge. Classic example is 9/11. Where immediately after the event, the pictures of the two towers crashing was shown again and again and again in order to traumatize the people and to stir up, in the American people in particular, the reaction that the governors, we'll call them the governors with a capital G, that the governors wanted, which is a reaction of let's go and hit those Arabs, let's invade Afghanistan, let's invade Iraq, let's smash the terrorists, let's give away all our liberties to our beloved government, because our government will save us from the terrorists. The terrorists are terrible. They've just brought down the two towers. Look at the terrible collapse. Look at the loss of life. Television smashed this lesson home, and it had the desired effect. The American people, with the Patriot Act 1 month later, which couldn't possibly have been written within a month, the Patriot Act just cashed in on this emotional reaction, which had been stirred up by television. And the governors took a great step forward in diminishing the liberties of the American people.
So one way we could look at these modern electronics is that they have us under a spell.
Yes. It's television is a magic lantern, and the internet is another magic lantern. Each little cell phone is a kind of magic lantern. There's something, if you watch, especially if it's children just standing in the street and watching television screens inside a shop window, they can't hear anything but just the pretty pictures flashing, continually flashing, the lovely colours. These attract. It has a mesmerizing effect. So there have been various studies of the effect of television upon human beings, and none of the studies are very reassuring. The television does not do good things to the human being.
Well, in British Columbia, there was a small town that couldn't pick up TV signals. And eventually, this barrier was overcome in the 1970s by, I guess, laying cables. And so TV was introduced later to this community than in most of the rest of Canada. So social scientists jumped on this opportunity to observe the effect that television had when it was introduced. And what these studies showed was that violence amongst the people increased and community involvement went down.
Yes, of course. Of course. The violence, I was going to say, and I forgot, the counterpart of this super passivity is the super activity of these frantic and rock and roll dancers. As the kids spend so much of their life being super passive in front of the television set or in front of the internet maybe, then it has to come out somehow, and it comes out in this crazy violence of these rock and roll concerts, for instance, and whatever is now taking their place. Is it rave parties? I don't know. But the drugs to blow their minds, and then the violence, yes, it's nature taking her revenge. Nature doesn't like super passivity. Men are not meant to be super passive. Nature's not meant to be super passive. And therefore there will be a kickback, and that kickback is violence.
Now, you mentioned music. Do you think that what is usually called rock music, or what we would call perhaps modern music, has a destructive impact?
Definitely. Rock music is a very general term, and it covers a variety, of kinds of music. So, rock music is not all of just one kind, it's a great variety. Nevertheless, what characterizes rock especially is the rhythm. The pulsating, monotonous, driving rhythm. It's not an interesting rhythm, it's just a pulsating rhythm. And this rhythm speaks to the animal in a human being. It doesn't speak to his mind. What speaks to the mind is melody. What speaks to the heart is harmony, and what speaks to the animal is rather the rhythm. So music which overemphasizes rhythm at the expense of the harmony and the expense of the melody, which gives the rhythm the prominence, is giving to the animal in human being the prominence. Man is an animal, but he's not only an animal, he's a rational animal. But the rock addresses primarily the animal, encourages the animal, brings out the animal, and the animal urges and destruction amongst them. Destruction, violence uncontrolled by reason, unguided by reason.
So music is a very strong tool, and it can be used, let's say, to elevate the soul, as in the case of Gregorian chant, or it can unleash these animal passions.
Yes. Music is a very powerful language of the soul. It, as you say, it can go from the highest to the lowest, and it can have either a very, it can have, for instance, a very soothing effect, or it can have a very violent effect. It can have a morally good effect, and it can have a very morally bad effect. There are certain kinds of music that Plato would have banned in his Republic, Aristotle the same. And the old Chinese proverb says, when the mode of the music changes, the walls of the city shake. And that's certainly what happened with rock music. As rock music came in the 1960s, there was a complete upheaval in life in the whole of the world in the 1960s.
Like an increase in sexual promiscuity.
Absolutely, and a lot of other things. With a lot of morality, a tremendous breakdown of morality, a breakdown of the old order. You may say the old order had to go. Well, whatever you say about it, that the 1960s is a huge issue. And music played a huge part in that revolution of the 1960s. And the mode of the music changed as rock music became universal in the 1960s, and the walls of the city shook. The walls of the city were shaken down, and the city's been rebuilt differently ever since.
Have revolutionaries used music again and again and again?
I think you would say so, yes. Luther certainly used music. He wrote hymns, and he wrote the words of hymns. He may even have written the music of hymns, I'm not sure. But he used hymns. The Catholic Church, of course, uses music, but not for revolution purposes, for godly purposes. The revolutionaries and the Catholics know the power of music, and the Church uses music for good, and the revolutionaries use music for revolution.
That's when the churchmen are seeing, because there was a revolution in church music too after Vatican II.
Yes, the music became not necessarily violent, but it definitely became sugary and sticky and sentimental. And it's a degraded music because of that. Music of much less value, of not great musical value.
Now the churchmen, that is the liberal churchmen, were hoping by modernizing the music that they would bring more young people into the churches. Has this strategy succeeded, do you think?
No. And the reason is, again, because if you try to reconcile godliness to godlessness, you're trying to mix oil and water. Rock music is the human animal in its godless, basically godless. It's intrinsically godless. The Catholic Church is godly. You can't use rock music to put over a message of God. It's not possible. Because rock music speaks to the animal, and the animal is not the part of the human being that responds to God. The animal needs to be integrated with the reason, and with the highest, the lowest part of man needs to be integrated with the highest in order to be led to God. And then the lowest part of man will be harmonized, will be tranquilized, will be ordered, brought to order under reason in order to go to God. The animal is not necessarily bad, but the animal must be subordinate to reason. Music which unleashes the animal without subordinating reason is incompatible with the purposes of God. And therefore, if the liberals bring in rock music into church, what it's going to do is make the children go to, the youngsters will go to the local discotheque where they will hear the rock music genuinely at full blast instead of at half blast, pretending to order it and make it lead to God. If they give the church a taste for anything like rock music, they will go to where the rock music is full blast and genuine, and they will leave the church. And the liberals should see this, but they're dumb, so they don't see it. They don't understand the way music works. They don't understand the way that godless culture works. You can't make a godless culture serve God. It's not possible. You've got to change the culture in order to let it serve God.
And isn't much of the modern music, rock music, whatever you want to call it, sometimes openly satanic?
Yes, it is. And again, that's logical. The animal human being uncontrolled by reason, again, he that is not with me is against me, he that gathers not with me scatters. And if human beings want to get into music, leaving God and reason and beauty and harmony and order, leaving all of that to one side, just unleashing the animal, it's bound to call in Satan, and Satan will come in sooner or later. And of course he is present in a great deal of the rock musicians yesterday, at least. I don't know about the rock musicians today. Most likely he's there as well. He's there, still there today. But it's notorious how much there has been of him in the leading rock musicians of the last, let's say, 40 years.
And so you see, in area after area, how, let's say, civilization itself in a way you could be, it could be said is unraveling. If, like another way you could describe some of this music, if it does appeal, let's say, to the animal instincts, like it's this is another step towards barbarism.
Yes. The youngsters are being turned into barbarians, and the music plays a large part in this. They're not being taught the values of civilization. They're not being taught what civilization is about. Basically, civilization is about our Lord Jesus Christ and going to heaven. And if civilization is no longer about that, if civilization is only about swimming pools and balance of payments and whatever, then rock music corresponds to that. If swimming pools are for the animal, mainly. Rock music is for the animal. The two go together, so to speak. And God will be left out of the picture. And barbarism will come back. Only it's post-Christian barbarism is going to be worse than pre-Christian barbarism.
In other words, like these post-Christian barbarians will be worse, let's say, than the Vikings.
Yes. Yes, that's already happening. I think so. Unless there's still something of the Christian influence at work. Because the Vikings still had common sense. They didn't send their women into battle, for instance. The men fought and the women stayed at home and had children, looked after the children. The Vikings had a lot of common sense. They may have been savages in some ways, but we were saying the common sense is being washed up. People are deliberately washing their own common sense out today. They're getting rid of it. They don't want it. Common sense is an infringement upon their liberty. They want liberty. And so they're going to get rid of their common sense.
So in other words, let's say sometimes at rock concerts you see outright destructive behavior. Could this kind of be in a way that these young people are sensing that this modern civilization is empty and they're reacting against it? They're just destroying what's left then?
That's definitely part of it. It's interesting to read the words of rock music, to see what the singers are actually singing, to see the words that they are singing. There's often a message, and it's a message very often of protest. The rock musicians are crying out, and nobody's listening. And they're crying out in protest against the whole materialistic way of life, but it's not as though they are genuinely seeking for something better. They're making a lot of money and they're making themselves famous by their protest. So they're quite happy to stay protesting. So, you know, you can't credit them with a real search for something better. Perhaps some of them do get to something better. But a lot of them stay right where they are because it's a very comfortable and famous way of living. But what they're saying is nevertheless very interesting. It's quite a coherent attack upon the materialistic way of life, materialistic modern society.
Do you think then that maybe the decline in the culture is really kind of a civilization in its death throes? Because Malcolm Muggeridge, he wrote about the great liberal death wish.
Yes.
And that seems to be happening today in various ways. For example, in most of the nations of what we call the West, the birth rate isn't even high enough to replace the people that are living today. Mm-hmm. So gradually, our nations are having a diminishing population.
Yeah. There's no doubt that the Western nations are dying because their birth rate is too low, as you say, even to replace. They are dying because the adults want the soft, easy, comfortable, pleasurable, selfish way of life. They don't want children. And behind this, if they don't want children, there is a death wish. They don't want life. They don't want life to. Yeah, they don't want to continue life. They don't want to play their part in continuing life by having children. There is a death wish behind liberalism, definitely. And the liberalism is the decadence of Western civilization. and that decadence is doomed.
Didn't John Paul II sometimes speak out against the culture of death?
Yes, he did. He did, and there he was right. He also is picking up that behind today's culture is a great death wish. Yes.
Because perhaps in this culture, ultimately, there really is nothing. I remember hearing about a song, a pop song by Bruce Springsteen entitled 57 Channels and Nothing On. So in other words, there's all this content in all these electronic media, but really there's nothing there. You just have sitcoms with not really any meaning to them.
Well, when you lose God, you lose everything. What is there in human beings? When you take out of a human being everything that is of God, what's left? Of course, you can't take out obviously everything, because then there'd be nothing at all. There'd be nothingness. But when a man gets rid of God out of his heart and mind, what's there left in his heart and mind and in his soul? So, just swimming pools and going down to the supermarket and cashing welfare stamps or collecting welfare stamps or whatever it is, going to work. In French they call it dodo maître boulot, or maître boulot dodo. Underground office sleep, underground office sleep, underground office sleep, maître boulot dodo. You know, what's the meaning of this life?
Did T.S. Eliot have something to say on the meaninglessness of modern life? Because the very title of one of his poems, The Hollow Man, seems to bring out this theme.
Even more famous than The Hollow Man is the great poem called The Wasteland, which is a portrait, like mosaics, which is a collection of fragments, of fragmentary takes of various scenes of life in a modern city, in London in particular. And it's a devastating picture of the meaninglessness of city life, big city life, in 1922, in the early part of the 20th century. The Hollow Man also. Yes, T.S. Eliot was very much onto the problem. Interestingly, the reason why T.S. Eliot was able to get hold of the problem is that he had received a very good cultural education at I think it was Harvard, and in case in the United States. He must have gone to a good school and then went to a good university. And in those days, the universities still taught the great masters, and they taught culture and they taught literature. And so Eliot knew very well Dante and Shakespeare especially, but he also knew Wagner, he knew Baudelaire, he knew many other poets and writers and the English dramatists. And because of this knowledge of the past, he was able to get an accurate picture of the emptiness and drabness and meaninglessness of modern life. It's because he knew meaning from the past that he could see how meaningless the present was. Today, when people don't learn that culture of the past, because that culture of the past condemns the present. And so, in order not to feel condemned in their meaningless modern lives, people want less and less of the old culture. They want more and more of the emptiness, empty and meaningless modern culture, because that doesn't tell them they're doing anything wrong. That tells them that everything is sweet and happy and smiley-smiley and up, and we're getting more and more progress and more money and more swimming pools. That's what they want to believe, and that's what they want to think.
But then sometimes maybe one of them has a tragedy in his or her personal life and then is just left searching around without any answers.
That's a gift of God. Those tragedies, either illness or somebody being killed in a road accident or whatever, that kind of tragedies is designed by God in order to make people think about what life is really about. Unfortunately, people don't always use the opportunity the way God means them to use it, and so the occasion is wasted. But Every funeral invites people to think about death, and people should think about death, but of course they don't want to. Especially modern people don't want to think about death.
So God sends out these kind of callings, but the problem is that some people don't respond to them.
I'd say a lot of people don't respond. They don't want to respond. God is the great loser. Heads people win, and tails God loses. If he punishes people, they protest and squeal, and if he doesn't punish them, they go on their merry old way. But they won't come back. The mass of people won't come back to God.
So then people are usually reached on one basis, that one here and one there will come back, but usually not a mass conversion then.
Today, it's difficult to reach people. They are shut-ins. They are mental and soul shut-ins. Their souls are shut into this self-sealed modern fantasy and the modern way of life, and it's very difficult to break in. Some writers try to use violence of some form or another to break in. An example might be Flannery O'Connor, whose short stories, as best I know, are filled with a kind of strange violence. But also, I think Mel Gibson's latest film, Apocalypto, is filled with horror and violence. What else gets through? People are so sunk in their fantasy. They're drowned in their fantasies. They're so captivated by their fantasy. They're so sunk in their slumber that, you know, an artist today must wonder how on earth do they get through to these people. And of course any Catholic priest also wonders. And as you say, it's a one-on-one, it's one-by-one, it's mass conversions just certainly don't happen today.
So, in other words, for most of humanity, they're still held spellbound by all these electronic technologies on the whole.
More and more people are spellbound. The other electronics are on the rise all the time. There's always some new invention. What was it, the cell phone, the iPod, the BlackBerry, there's some new development, some new gadget. Some new doodad every few years, as you were saying a few moments ago. They're dazzling, brilliant machines, but they are completely mesmerizing people. And it's very difficult to get through. It's very difficult to break through. Heads, people win. Tails, God loses. So he is surely going to allow people to be punished by where they have sinned, as you say. They're already punished by the inhuman life they lead in these big cities. They're already punished by this dreadful slumber in which they are liable to be caught at death, and then heaven knows what happens to their souls. If they're asleep at the switch when they die, God knows what happens to their souls. But that's the way people are, the mass of people today.
Now let's contrast this rather dreary situation to how, let's say, things were when, let's say, Europe was thoroughly Christian. We've talked about the drabness of modern society, but it seems like medieval Europe was exactly the opposite. There was all kinds of pilgrimages and local festivals. How did all this disappear?
Well, it arose... I have to say again, it arose with the faith and it died away as the faith died away.
So in actuality, this is a fairly consistent formula then. Faith breeds good culture, and the lack of faith then causes the dying of this culture.
Surely. Surely.
Now, how was entertainment done in Catholic civilization?
Well, entertainment is sort of a modern idea. When people lived a life in the country and they worked on the land, I guess they had local music. Somebody played a zither, some local instrument, not necessarily anything as complicated as a violin. Probably they had some kind of guitar. I don't know. some kind of simple instruments, and somebody played local dances. There were, of course, no cinema, no television, no... Somebody told stories. There may have been storytellers, but it was all living. It was all local. It was all organic, so to speak. It was all fresh. And then, of course, people had the church. If in those days people lived around the church, they lived mentally. Their minds were occupied by the church, as today people's minds are occupied by television. So they lived in and around the church, and as you say, various festivals. The church season, they lived very much by the church season, the liturgical year.
So people lived around the liturgical year then?
Surely, yes. In the Middle Ages in Europe, that's the Catholic Middle Ages of Europe, the church played as large a part in their minds as television plays in people's lives today. Today, television and politics, then the church.
Well, what we're getting at then is that Catholic civilization is very locally based. People, if there is entertainment, people produce it locally. They do things for themselves. Whereas in today's society, entertainment, it's piped in from somewhere else.
It's piped in from Australia, it's piped in from the other side of the world. It's global. Yes, and it's electronic. Yes, it was, everything was local, and there wasn't the same, the whole structure of life is different. There's not the same need for entertainment that there is today. People's lives were not so dull. People's lives were much more real during the day, moment by moment during the day. Today, you know, there's something wrong in the structure of life. Because let me paint a scenario. Dad has to get up at, let's say, 7 o'clock in the morning. He rushes, he gulps down a cup of coffee. He gets into the car. He spends an hour and a half driving amidst fumes and anger and traffic jams and frustration till he gets to the office. He goes into the office. It's overheated during the winter. It's garish neon lighting. He spends his day pushing paper in a more or less futile kind of work. And he knows it's deep down he knows it's futile. It's nothing like the man pushing a plow through a field to make sure that there are potatoes on the table in February and March. It's nothing like that at all. When a man knows that his own direct physical efforts are going to feed directly his own family at the table, then his work has a meaning. When a man knows that, you know, well, of course, all work is sanctified by the family if it's for the family, so even pushing paper can be sanctified in a way, but there's no comparison between pushing the plow and pushing paper.
Well, I remember when I worked at an office that the number one topic of conversation was what people were going to do during their holidays or during the weekend.
That's it. See, the fabric of life during the day is empty. Whereas when you're living a healthy life in, as they used to live, let's say, the fabric of the day was not empty. Today it is. So dad spends an empty day, he then gets back into the motor car, another hour or hour and a half of fumes and frustration and anger, finally he gets home. He's good for nothing but to be entertained. He's good for nothing but flop down in a chair, open a can of beer. He doesn't even want to talk to his children. They're too demanding. He wants to get the children out of the way. Hey, if it's $20, go to an amusement arcade. Get out of my way. He just wants to sit down and push on the automatic control and just get one thing coming up after another on the television screen. He sits there and will just let it wash over. That's all he's got the mental energy left for. He's been drained by this frustrating and futile life. And as you say, he only sort of comes to life at the weekends and holidays. But it's weekends and holidays are not a real life. So the day-to-day life is unreal and the vacation life is unreal. It's not a real life. It's a hollow life. They're hollow men. And the hollow marriages, hollow families, it's terrible.
Well, another thing we note about modern civilization that it has a natural tendency then to break down the family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Whereas, you know, when a man, let's say, was working on the land, the more boys he had to help him, the better. So he wasn't using birth control. He wanted more boys. And if the girls came along instead, well, the girls could marry the boys, and all the girls could obviously do the homework, the work at home, washing and cooking and stitching and darning and looking after the house. And you know, that again had meaning because they were doing it for their own brothers and husbands and fathers. It's not an empty day.
Well, didn't Chesterton write about the movement into the cities in England? And he deplored it because once you move into the cities, it puts pressure on these families to use birth control in order to limit the size of their families.
Absolutely, because the children in the city are not the same thing at all. It's, in many apartment blocks, you can't get in. They won't let you have an apartment if you've got more than two children. Or they want you to have no children at all. Because children are nuisance. Children are noisy. Children are a nuisance in the big city way of life. So the whole structure of life.
So the whole structure of life kind of then works against the family.
Works against family and works against healthy culture. It generates by itself this unhealthy culture. This unhealthy culture of artificial entertainment. Of artificial and electronic entertainment. And the weekend mentality, the vacations mentality, as you say, the only thing that people want to do in the office is to get away from it. It's absolutely unfulfilling their work.
Perhaps then the TV set is a more of a symptom of the problem than the actual problem, because people have meaningless work, and so they're gravitating the TV in an attempt to find something to hang on to.
Well, the television set corresponds to the modern way of life. You get these big cities, you know, you haven't got countryside to run around in. You can't run around in the streets because of the traffic. You've got to stay inside. If you stay inside and don't talk to anybody, you're not seeing your neighbors and not chatting with your neighbors, you're going to go crazy. You need some substitute. And the soap operas are a substitute village. The soap opera is a substitute way of living in a society and with the interest of what's going on in the society. That used to be the village life, and the soap operas are a substitute. And it's an electronic and artificial substitute. But it shows the need in the big city for human nature still needs social life. And it's going to create these artificial substitutes if it's not going to get the social life in a natural form. So the whole structure of modern life, the whole modern life, and it's an interesting question exactly what are the elements in modern life that do this, but the whole modern life creates modern culture. Then modern culture is the symptom and the cause. It's both. As you said, television is the symptom, the manifestation, and the cause. Modern life causes television. Television causes modern life. The two interact. And the problem is piling up all the time.
Now, I would like to talk with you about Pope Benedict the 16th, as we have not had a chance to discuss this pontificate, as the last set of interviews we did was just about the time of John Paul II's death before Benedict had been elected. Now, we've talked about culture, and Pope Benedict is apparently a lover of classical music. Does this make him one of us?
Dare I say, speaking with all respect to the Holy Father, dare I say that his love of Mozart, I would say, is certainly a good sign. Mozart is extremely human, and he was only end of the 18th century, and he was definitely came from a Catholic culture. Even when he was a Freemason, he was writing out of his Catholicism. So, love of Mozart is a good sign. But is Mozart enough? Is loving Mozart enough for a pope? I'm afraid not. another of the modern theologians, Father Hans Urs von Balthasar, a modernist theologian, one of the thinkers of Vatican II, he was a great lover of Mozart, which suggests that to love Mozart is not enough. It's good, but it's not enough for a priest or for a theologian or for a pope.
Or for anyone, because in Canada we had a prime minister recently. His name was Paul Martin Jr., and he loved classical music. He liked the old things. He disliked some of the modern technologies, so I hear that in his office the VCR player was just left flashing. He was also a regular churchgoer, a Catholic, and yet during his prime ministership he was promoting legalized abortion and same-sex marriage.
Oh, modern politics. A lot of these prime ministers and presidents are just puppets. And there's, in their defense, maybe there's not much that they can do about what goes on underneath them. The real leaders of the world are not the public leaders. The real leaders are like the Freemasons and those like Freemasons who pull the strings behind the scenes.
So in other words, our legislatures, our parliaments are not really the ones today that are calling the shots. They are just implementing what's being decided somewhere else.
Yes, sure. Yes. It's the show, the public show for quote-unquote democracy, but the real power and the real decisions are made elsewhere.
And if there is, let's say, a prime minister who would stand strong, probably this person would be then cast aside.
Yes, they'd get rid of him. They would put him in power to serve their purpose, and once he'd served their purpose, they'd get rid of him. Yeah. Disraeli, a famous English prime minister of the middle of the 19th century, who was Jewish, Disraeli said that the world is governed, this is middle of the 19th century, the world is governed by far different people from what people, by far different from men from what people think. So you know, you think that the president and the prime minister are the real powers in the land, they're not. Another very famous prime minister of England in the 19th century, Gladstone, William Ewart Gladstone, realized that it wasn't Parliament that had the power, it was the City of London, where the money was, the City of London had the power. And there was nothing he could do about it, as best I remember. There was very little he could do about it. But where, you know, money talks, so the money people hold the power, the real power.
Do you think that in the church, today in reality, it's much the same, that perhaps Pope Benedict the 16th is not really the one in the church with the power?
I think it's, yes, I think so. Mark Hugh, he has the authority because he is the Pope. I mean, I do believe, some people think he isn't the Pope, but personally I do believe he is the Pope. The Society of Christ Attendants acts absolutely on the basis that he is the Pope. So let's assume he is the Pope. If he is the Pope, he has the authority. He has an immense authority. He has a divine authority. And he could use it. But what mainly stops him from using it is his own mind. His ideals are not clear. I think personally, God knows, he's a decent man. I think he has a good heart and a twisted head. He's read too much modern philosophy and he believes in modern philosophy, and therefore his head is all over the place. But he doesn't mean, I think he means well, and I think he's trying to do the right thing. He wants to rescue the church, but again, he's not got, how can I say, he's a virtual pope. He's not a real pope, he's a virtual pope, in the sense that he's with, especially with his ideas, he's not got the controls in his hands. Now, if he changed his ideas, if he got fully old-fashioned, let's call them old-fashioned, Catholic ideas in his head, like the Pope governs the church, the Pope calls the shots, the Pope makes the decisions, and the Pope lays down the law. The Pope is the monarch, the king of the church. If he thought like that, and he took some brave and courageous decisions, the others would have to assassinate him. They would have to assassinate him or drug him or cripple him or blackmail him. They would have to do something fast. At the moment, they don't need to do something like that because he thinks too much like they do. So he's doing what they want without their having to force him. But if he started thinking in a very different way, in a thoroughly and totally Catholic way, they would be obliged to assassinate him, as very probably they assassinated John Paul I.
So really, then, what we need is a martyr pope.
Yes. And not just one, we need five in succession in order to open Catholics, to make the sacrifice of blood of five martyr popes, like at the beginning of the Church. The Church was built by a series of martyr popes, and it needs to be rebuilt by some martyr popes, I mean, you could think. I don't know if that's how God is going to rebuild his Church, but that's one way it could happen. But the trouble is that the governors, spelled with the capital G, govern the conclaves as well, have means of controlling the conclaves, and they would never, if they could possibly help it, they would never let anybody with martyr pope ideas get elected as pope. The only hope, so to speak, is that one pope after another, once he became pope, would be enlightened by God, like very possibly John Paul I was being. I'm not saying that he had all things straight, but he was getting things straight. He was beginning to take some strong decisions. He was going to get rid of some higher Freemasons, and the Freemasons killed him before he got to them. If we had a series of five martyr popes, if only five popes like that could get elected in five conclaves in about 5 months, then Catholics might wake up to what's really going on, and then the situation might change. I don't think that's how the Church is going to be rescued by God. The Church is going to be rescued by the consecration of Russia to the Immaculate Heart, which will happen, as our Lord said, but it will be moved.
But so far, I don't think we're at that point, because don't you believe that Pope Benedict is still, in his mind, he has a lot of modernism in his thinking?
Yes, I think that's true, and therefore I don't think he's... Apparently, he set up a commission to study Fatima again. It's said that he regrets the part that he played in the burying of Fatima in 2000. That's a way of describing what the Vatican did to Fatima in 2000. It's said that he regretted the part he played in that. Apparently, he says that his hand was forced, whatever that means. In other words, but he realized that he did something there that he shouldn't have done, perhaps, or something that shouldn't have been done. So he's got some of the right instincts and some of the right wishes and some of the right intentions, but has he got the clarity of mind and has he got the real power? I was saying, if he had the clarity of mind and he took a really Catholic position, the others, the power would come to him. The power would come back to him, which is why the others would have to kill him. Which is why I say the others may well have killed John Paul I, because if John Paul I had started to get rid of the Freemasons, and if he continued along that line, then more and more power would have come back to the Pope. More and more authority and power would have come to him. And that's why the others had to get rid of him. And the others put in position popes who they can rely on not having fully Catholic thinking, and that way they don't need to blackmail them or kill them.
But certainly, maybe Benedict XVI has got far enough to know that he has a problem on his hands.
He certainly seems to be aware of a problem, yes. And by the constant talk that there has been over the last, I don't know how long, year and a half, of this motu proprio on the Mass, freeing up the traditional rite of Mass, by this constant talk of the motu proprio, it surely shows that the Pope wants to free the old rite of Mass. Again, that's part of his decency and part of his good instincts. Whether he's got the strength to overcome the enormous opposition inside the Church to the old Mass, I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's been so often announced that it's going to appear and then it hasn't appeared. It's now being announced for before Easter, during the month of March. I don't know. The opposition is very strong. The Freemasons have got enormous power inside the Vatican.
But could it be said, too, that in many ways, this pontificate is much the same as the last one?
Judged by the fruit so far, there's not been much difference in public. I think you could say that. The Pope Benedict XVI is obviously not travelling as much as John Paul II used to travel. But maybe Benedict XVI is acting in private to put some better people in positions of influence inside the Vatican. I don't know. Some people say it's just the same as before. Some people say that given time and things will take a turn for the better. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Do you think that maybe things have deteriorated to the point where none of those measures are going to be strong enough, and that really what we need is a chastisement from God to pull us out of this corruption and lethargy?
Personally, I think, and have thought for a while, that it's going to come finally to a chastisement, yes. But between now and the chastisement, I think the Lord God is going to pull his church straight, so that the church can then go into the chastisement and come out the other side. And I think that the official church, the structures of the official church, need to be straightened out, or strengthened, purified and strengthened, before the chastisement comes. If the chastisement, for instance, happened now, I don't know if the church would pull through. Well, of course it would, because God, there's no way the church is not going to pull through. God would arrange it in one way or another. But it seems to me more possible, and possibly more likely, that as the corruption goes on today, and the corruption is day by day, the reaction is that there is a reaction coming. There are a lot of priests who are interested in being able to say the old rite of Mass again. And that would make a big difference. Even if they didn't do it perfectly right from the start, if they just picked up the old rite of Mass, a lot of grace would flow. And they would. A lot of these priests, I'm not saying there's a huge number of them, absolutely speaking, but a number of the priests who would pick up the Mass would pick up the ball and run with it. They'd go and go and go until they came perhaps all the way back to the complete old religion.
Do you think that some of the lack of morality in modern civilization, the explosion of sin and corruption, and let's say to use an example, there's so much pornography on the television screens and on the internet, that this is a result of grace drying up?
Yes. The Mass, the true Mass, was replaced by the new Mass in 1969, and abortion, Roe and Wade in the United States was 1973. Abortion in England, I think, was 1967.
And in Canada, it was 1969.
There we are, the very year of the new Mass. The taking away of the old rite of Mass, the taking away of the sacrifice, made sin and made life much easier for the devil.
One of the characteristics of modern civilization seems to be that whoever is in charge seems to be deliberately kind of setting up a situation of that they're encouraging, like a state of rebellion. And it seems like, let's say, there's so much role reversal going on. For example, some people who have studied the criminal justice system say that the criminals actually are given more rights than the police officers or the victims. Do you think that this is the case? That what might be the strategy here?
The strategy of those we'll call the governors with a capital G, the people who are really ruling things, let's say the Freemasons, if you like, though they're not all Freemasons. The strategy is to the breakdown of law and order, the breakdown of the old order, in order to bring on the new order. And the new order will be complete control by these people. And it will be the complete end of democracy. Democracy will be completely discredited and got rid of. And in its place will come world government by these people who consider themselves fit to govern the world.
So really this stage of rebellion is just that. It's a stage, because there's a certain paradox here. You have the powers that be encouraging this rebellion.
Yes.
For example, like in schools, teachers find they can't do anything because
yes.
they have no authority to discipline
yes,
the children
that's
anymore.
Right, that's right.
And yet at the same time, you notice kind of a police state beginning to emerge in all the democratic countries of the West.
Yeah.
In other words, some observers have said that what we have today is really a sham democracy, not a real democracy.
Of course it isn't. Of course it isn't really a government by the people. It's government, it's secret government. It's governed by secret powers behind the scenes. And again, I take the 11th of September as a classic example. Apparently that is 19 Arabs, and it's a vicious attack upon a wonderful American democracy. It's nothing of the kind. It's the government. It was an inside job of the powers that be that rule the world, who absolutely want the American public to give away their democracy and to give away their rights and to give away their liberties, so that the police state, the global police state, will take over. And that's where we're going to.
So in a way, it's like the Russian Revolution. The communists kind of, at first, encouraged a lot of disorder.
Yes.
And then the people were actually accepted the heavy hand in order to end this anarchy.
Yes, that's the process. It's exactly the same process. And we're well on the road to that kind of communism. Of course, the name has changed. Globalism is at the moment soft, whereas communism is hard. But globalism could easily, once it triumphs, it could easily turn hard. These people want power, they want global power, they want complete power over the whole world. And they're well on the way to getting it. I don't know whether the Lord God is going to allow them to get it, or the Antichrist will get it, for 3.5 years. I don't know whether these people will get it, they may or may not. That's God's plan. I don't think that they will, but they're very close to it right now. It seems to them absolutely within their grasp, and of course, these people, you know, the power you need in order to pull off a stunt like the 11th of September is pretty great. You've got to control the government, obviously, and you've got to control the media, and with that, you can be pretty sure of getting away with it, and that's what they've done. They've got away with it, and only the internet has really made easily available the information necessary to see that the 11th of September, was a gigantic globalist stunt.
So the internet is both then a good thing and a bad thing, because there's a lot of filth on the internet.
There's not only filth, there's a complete anarchy of opinions and statements of opinions, but there is truth. There is truth available on the internet, which is available nowhere else. You've got to know what you're looking for. But if you know what you're looking for, then you can find a lot of material available on the internet, which you certainly don't find in the viral media.
Now, another characteristic that we've talked about a lot is the moral rottenness of our society, let's say with all the pornography and sexual promiscuity. Do you think that this is the worst feature of modern civilization?
No, I don't think so. Because it's only the sixth and ninth commandments, let's say. The first command is much more important than this. Well, all the commandments are important, but the first command is the most important of all. And that's, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and thou shalt adore the Lord thy God, and thou shalt have no other gods before me. And that's the one that modern society, the whole world today, is defying. And those are the gravest sins, the sins against God.
So the sins against God, if they're broken, it simply leads the other commandments then being broken.
That's exactly right. St. Paul says that homosexuality is due to idolatry. He says it in the first chapter of the Epistle of the Romans. And he says that people get into homosexuality because they commit idolatry. In other words, they break the first commandment and then they break the sixth. And that's encouraging for people trapped in problems of the sixth, because it says that if people trapped in problems of the sixth obey the first commandment, that will help them to get out of problems of the sixth.
That's a way to get out of their sins, then.
Is to get back to worshipping and adoring the one true God. And that will give them a considerable help to get out of a trap of one kind or another of some sin against the sixth commandment.
Do you think that perhaps this moral rottenness is also part of a plan being used by the architects of the New World Order. In other words, they're encouraging this moral rottenness because it makes it easier for them to control people.
There's no question about it. In the Old Testament again, when Balak wanted to defeat the Israelites, he adopted the plan of corrupting their morals, because if you could corrupt their morals and get them to turn against God, to disobey God, then they would lose the friendship of God and they would lose the protection of God. And just the same with the relics of the Christian West. The communists, it used to be the communists undermining the morals of the West. Now it's the globalists. But the globalists are simply the soft version of hard communism. But as I say, globalism will gain turn hard if and when it needs it, as soon as it's in strong enough position. But the communists are behind a lot of rock music.
Even though they didn't allow it in their own countries.
That's right, but they promote it in the West. And they will promote anything that rots the morals and rots and weakens the West. And the globalists are now doing the same thing without any doubt at all.
Now, in a nutshell, what do you think is modern culture? Is it really a culture at all, or is it really, when it comes right down to it, an anti-culture?
Well, it all depends how you define culture. If you define culture as simply what all the activities by which men show what they think and mean and believe about life, like the kind of shoes they wear, like the kind of food they eat, like the kind of cakes they make, then fast food and jeans and sloppy shoes and filthy dress and lousy music, all of that is culture in that very broad sense. If you take culture in the meaning of, for instance, the finest and best that men have ever thought about life and the world and so on, then modern culture is not culture but an anti-culture. In fact, it's an anti-Christian culture, because the world divides for or against Christ. The liberals don't like that idea that you have to be either for or against Christ. They'd much rather be neither. But our Lord says, he that's not with me is against me. And so what you've got, in fact, is the question of culture comes back deep down. It comes back to for or against our Lord Jesus Christ. The culture against Christ is anti-culture, in fact. And the culture that's for and with Christ and comes from Christ is culture in the true sense.